Hello everybody, welcome to the New in Chess podcast, where we talk to grandmasters, authors, trainers, and other personalities from the fascinating world of chess. The New in Chess podcast is brought to you by DGT, the leading producer of clocks and sensory chess boards. My name is Dick-Jan ten Geuzendam. Today's podcast once again reaches you from Paphos in Cyprus, where at the luxurious Cup St. George Hotel, the candidates tournament has come to an end after 2 weeks of excitement and tension. My guest is Anish Giri, one of the main protagonists in this grueling battle to determine the challenger of the world champion Gukesh later this year. Anish was one of the pre-tournament favorites and one of the absolute stars of the candidates, but in the end, he too had to bow to the exceptional performance of the winner 20-year-old Yavukir Sindarov from Uzbekistan. Anish finished in second place, 1.5 points behind the winner, Sindarov, but 1 full point ahead of third place, Fabiano Caruana, another clear pre-tournament favorite. Of course, finishing second in such an elite field is a marvelous result, but it's also the cruelest of results in a cutthroat competition where only first place really counts. Anish, welcome to the podcast. Great that you find time for us. How mixed are your feelings?
I think, to be fair, I was experiencing, you know, lots of ups and downs in terms of my hopes. I wouldn't call them expectations, but more in terms of like hopes of, for the tournament. Of course, before the tournament, I was very hopeful. The first round was a big setback. After that, my hopes, you know, they fell through.
Well, then, was it that bad? I mean,
yeah, I think that if you lose the first round, I don't. You probably know better, but has there been any candidates winner who lost the first round?
There could be a first there.
Yeah, exactly.
But I mean, you're very experienced. You are planning for 14 rounds.
Yes, of course I was, but I don't think. I think maybe once in Vikanzai, I started with a loss, and I did very well. I don't know if I won that year. I think I lost to Nepo in first round and came back against Kramnik in the second. But in the field, this strong and tournament is difficult. And anyway, it was an uphill battle to win it. And also, we started with a loss. I mean, obviously, it's not. I'm not saying that I gave up, right? I continued playing. But I'm just saying that my
momentum affected you.
Yeah, well, not necessarily affected me, but it affected my, not expectation, but my state, like my hopefulness, you know? Mm-hmm. So I was very hopeful at the beginning, before the start. I was very, that hopefulness sort of dropped, took a big hit after first round. Mm-hmm. Then it has completely resurged after the fourth round, when I got back with the win. Then it dipped a little bit after a couple of draws. And then it went, the hopefulness sort of was peaking after I beat Fabi. So I won two games. First Prague, then Fabi.
And this is in the second half.
Yes, exactly. Know. And at that point, I was extremely hopeful, of course, because my chances, well, they're still around 10% maybe, but it started to take some shape. And then, they were sort of gradually crushed for the next few days to the point that, you know, yeah, I have experienced the gradual, slow pain that has peaked in the round before last when the tournament was essentially over. And then since that moment, I've won against Bluebaum. And I've had, you know, all these days to get used to the notion that I'm not going to win the tournament, that right now I feel actually on a high.
Really?
Yeah, I feel good right now because, you know, the delta of my feeling, like compared to the, it's been going up for the couple of days, right? So I already knew that it's not going to happen when I played this Javahir. After I didn't beat Ve'i, it was clear I cannot win the tournament because even if I beat Javahir, it was clear he plays last round with Ve'i. And Ve'i just does not have the weaponry right now. Well, he probably has, but he just wouldn't be motivated to try to beat Javahir. And we saw what happened in the game. It would have been the same if I was training Javahir. It would have been the same. So it was over in like 5 minutes. I don't know how many minutes.
Yeah, it was just a non-game. Right?
Yeah, and nowadays the state of theory is such that if a player playing white wants to do it against someone like Ve'i, and Ve'i has no incentive to play for a win, he can just shut down the game. And he will. So basically, I had no real hopes after not beating Ve'i. And already then for the next 2 days, I already knew I'm not going to win the tournament, right?
Mm.
So then it would be strange to then beat Bluebaum and then feel upset, right? Like,
yeah.
No, that was good. I already knew I was not going to win the tournament, and now I knew that I was not going to win the tournament, but at least I beat Bluebaum. So I was happy. And that's why the last day, I felt good because it's been a good day. I mean, it's...
Yeah. No, I thought, I mean, after you recovered so, well, strongly, I mean, you not only won several games, but you also won them in a very nice manner and very convincing manner. Then there was this game against Wei Yi in round 12 when you actually have a winning position. And it is difficult, but I can imagine that after that game you were dejected.
Yes, though, again, to be fair, I was upset, of course, that I couldn't win this game. And of course, if you like really zoom in on the situation, and you could say that yes, it was a big miss, because the chances went finally to zero.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be really also unfair to Jevo here to say that I was close. I mean, with three games to go, I understood my only chance is to win the last three games. Like, when does it happen that on demand in a top tournament do you finish with three wins, of which two games are black, one of them is against Wei? It's a white game is against the leader, who is on plus six unbeaten, and you have the last round against Bluebaum, who is the most solid player in the world and is extremely well prepared, and nobody can even touch him with white, let alone with black. So frankly, it is such an uphill battle, and my chances were so bad at that point. But of course, there was a room for miracle, and the whole cycle, you're hoping for those miracles, and some of them happen, like me qualifying to Canada's through Grand Suisse, it's a bit of a miracle as well. So of course I was hoping for miracles, and of course and it was kind of shaping up to be one. Though at that point, not only the problem was that I didn't convert it's not like convert, like there were a few wins, I didn't see a clear one. So let's say, okay, I felt I could maybe win somewhere. So not only did I not win, but also Jawahir saved the game against Fabi. Because, of course, the ideal for me would be if I had won that game and Jawahir would lose to Fabi.
Sure.
Then the situation would be a lot better. Then I have some real chance.
Yeah.
Still an underdog, of course, but I would have some real chances.
Mm.
But yeah, it was... He played so well. Jawahir played so well. And he had such a margin that at no point did I get close enough, I guess, to truly experience the heartbreak of not making it.
Yeah. Well, it's clear that with a tournament like this, you not only have to play well, you also need luck. And one of the pieces of luck you needed was him losing against Fabiano.
And many more things, yeah.
Yeah, and many more things. But at the same time, I mean, your finish in the Grand Swiss was also very confident and strong. So you never know. And let's say, going by the chess that you've been playing for quite some time now, I mean, I think I was not the only one who thought that you were one of the favorites.
Yeah, but of course I have there's some tendency, especially the way my opponents are playing against me often. They often choose some very solid setups, and there is a tendency that sometimes it appears the game from the outside, it might appear that I haven't taken enough risk to win the game. And I had that same feeling here when I'd say I made some draws with white against Bluebaum and against Sipenko perhaps, and against Wei with white as well. But at the same time, the event in Grand Suisse, for example, was the place where I did win a lot of these positions, so it's kind of difficult to say exactly what my chess looks like, because I sort of depend on I'm off a lot of the games, I'm playing them on, like, I'm trying to nurture a very small advantage, and sometimes I can convert a few of them in a row and then assemble a streak of wins, like in the Grand Suisse. And sometimes it doesn't happen. And sometimes something in between happens, like here. So like I won against Prague, but I didn't win against Sipenko. And so like, sometimes people even could say that maybe with this approach, sort of, I'm not dangerous enough to win Canada's tournament, because There's a tendency that a lot of my games don't really, I don't sort of generate enough winning opportunities, but.
Well, generating winning opportunities is something that also depends on your opponent.
But again, if there are, let's say, there is a sort of tendency, if you look through my games, maybe more so than some other players, like I tend to go for the small advantages quite a lot. I sort of really insist on it quite persistently. And sometimes it seems a little bit, from even to me from the inside, but also from the outside, it seems a little bit like, am I not overdoing that a little bit too much?
Too meek.
Shouldn't I do something a little wilder? And if this doesn't work, then it's tempting to think that maybe I should have tried something more wild. Because unlikely with the approach of going for small advantages that you will be able to score six wins like Jawahir, right?
Yeah.
He had, I mean, his tournament had its own story, and a lot of it was some sort of wild counter-attacking thing where, like, in Ispenko, he came back from behind in a very, but very complex position, though, you know? So you could argue that maybe sometimes it's better, instead of having a small advantage, to have a big disadvantage and have a sharp position, right?
Yeah.
And win, like Joe here beat Ispenko. So these are always questions that are hard to answer, and certainly when the result doesn't fully go your way, and here that the desired result in the first place, then you can start questioning the entire strategy, let's say. But I think overall, I mean, I won four games here, which was very good. I also was quite happy before the tournament when I played in Vikanze. I won also quite a few games there. I think something similar. I think I also won like three games maybe, which was a good sign. You know, I could still win games against top opposition. So I think winning four games is pretty good. I could even maybe have won a few more. It was a special tournament also in a sense that I think the Canadas sometimes this result is even good enough for the first place.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to say. I mean, it might as well have been a tie for first or.
Yeah, but at the same time, if you look at that I was behind Sindarov by 1.5 points, you might wonder, you know, let's say after having beaten Prague and Fabi, or after having beaten Isipenko in the first game, maybe I should have tried to make something more of my next games, you know, to keep the momentum. Because if I look at those games, it looks as though they were somewhat anticlimactic, you know? Like I was sort of building towards, like my play was improving, I was building towards a streak of wins. And then there is this game, like let's say against VE or Bluebaum, that you click through that game and you wonder like, did you even really get to press, you know? Or rather like, yeah, I mean, shouldn't I have done something better there? But I think it's difficult to judge because, you know, sometimes it works out. Like if I look at the Grand Swiss, you know, I've beaten Jordan and Hans also from a very, very small advantages. Because the truth is that if the players with the black pieces, if they want to suffer nowadays, it's very hard to stop them from suffering.
Yeah, but in those two games that you mentioned, then, I mean, the position may be equal, but it's in both cases, they were trickier for your opponent.
This was the case here also against VE and Bluebaum and Ispenko.
Yeah.
But here it didn't manage to win them.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, it's a tricky approach. You know, like I think maybe like going for some wicked attack, you know, and just more of a, like a do or die approach, it would seem a bit more intuitive maybe in those moments to do that. And I was ready to do it in certain games, but my opponents really try to, like, they really want to suffer sometimes. And I feel sometimes like, who am I to stop them, you know?
Well, I mean, you're not the only one who's now thinking about what possibly you did wrong or you could have done slightly better. Take someone like Fabiano, who was, well, probably the person who was named most of the time as the outspoken favorite. How do you see his performance?
His story is very different. I mean, although he was a favorite to win the tournament, of course, he was not a favorite against the field, right? It's not like he had more than 50% chance. So just saying that he didn't win, so he failed, is also wrong. But he did underperform. I think he even lost rating here,
mm-hmm.
which is, which is not good for him. Of course, he doesn't want to underperform. You need to overperform massively here. Like, I gained a lot of rating here, but it's not enough. Fabio, of course, needed to gain a lot of rating too to fight for. And his result, I think plus one finally, plus one is never enough for the first place. So he's definitely not happy with his result. And I guess his tournament sort of broke in the middle somewhere. If you look at the scoreboard, you could say that he started well in terms of points. And then you could see that, after he lost just a bunch of games, he lost to Jawahir, mutual encounter, which was really important. I think the game must have been very painful for him, because I think in that game he started questioning his entire strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that he lost one more to Hikaru again. He has lost many games to Hikaru in this very, very unpleasant way, where it looks as though Hikaru isn't even playing for a win,
mm-hmm.
which he does, because he beats him all the time.
Yeah, but, yeah.
Fabiano must be puzzled, like, how can he keep losing to Hikaru? Yeah. And every time it happens, he's probably already having these fears, like, oh my God, it's happening again.
Yeah.
And then he lost to me in a game where he was already in a must-win and a desperate state. And after that, he felt there is no coming back. And I think there was no coming back. So after that, he just basically finished the tournament. And towards the end, we saw again, like, I mean, we'll see the same thing. I think the tournament will finish. Fabiano will be back to 2800. For the next candidates, he'll be again the favorite. There'll be again some young world champion who will again be very unstable. Mm. It will be all the same all over again.
Could be.
I think so. It will be.
Yeah, but let's say in Fabiano's case, there were also people who were saying, well, he was taking too much risk.
Yeah, he already knew it and he was trying not to.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if the risk is the right word. Mm. But I think what happens to Fabiano is that I am absolutely sure he lost... he lost belief in his own strategy. I think he started questioning it.
And how would you describe his strategy?
Okay, I mean, I don't want to sort of over elaborate on these things, but I saw a few interviews of his, and I think this whole idea of taking risks appropriately, it is bugging him. He mentioned in various interviews before the start even that he's not very good at taking the right amount of risk, because he feels he does it too much. So he was already worried about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he sort of saw it like, I think it's a bit in his head as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's currently feeling that he is not able to find the right way to take the risks.
Yeah.
And it could be one of those things where the problem is in your own head, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it's there already. So,
well, that's what I was thinking. I mean, there was every reason for people to think that he was a pre-tournament favorite. He had every reason to think so.
Yeah.
And will have told himself, don't think this. But at the same time, this also may work against you. I mean, subconsciously.
I think he didn't like the start of the tournament, the way the games went. I mean, he was a pre-tournament favorite, absolutely. We play again in a week or maybe in a month. I'm betting on him again. Everybody's betting on him again. He remains a favorite. And you could even see, like, even the last game of him, like, he beat Spenko, just looked through the game, and he's extremely strong.
Yeah.
It was a very complex game, and he just played like a machine.
Mm-hmm.
He is really, really good. And even the final result is decent. You know, he only lost rating because his rating is extremely high. So he's a good player. But I think that the way the tournament started, the way the games went, he didn't like how they went. And I think and I know that for myself, that's something I was also working on before tournament a lot. I think when you start questioning your strategy in the middle of the event, it's a very bad thing. Like, you lose confidence.
Mm-hmm. And how was that in your own case? I mean, you lost this first game, but it looked as if you, well, recovered admirably. Just forget about the first game. We look at your tournament. It's a great tournament.
Yeah, I did fine. I mean, I was, of course, a lot is dependent on good luck and bad luck. So first game was bad luck. Other games were good luck. So all that, of course. But as I said, I have recovered, of course. But not to the point that I could fight for the first place, because I think, again, it is difficult. because, you know, for every loss you have, you need to win two. So it's expensive. So I wanted to not lose, but it's difficult because I wanted, my plan was to win and not lose, and it's very difficult.
This podcast is brought to you by DGT, the chess innovators. At DGT, we want to bring people together and help them grow through play by supporting chess and creating innovative, high-quality products for players everywhere. To find your nearest DGT dealer, please visit our website at dgt.nl.
Well, there was this tricky time control here without increment, which was also used in Wagon's Ace, so it gave you some practice there.
Yeah, I think that was usual.
Yeah, is that was that very useful to have that training? Because I think switching from increment to non-increment is huge.
No, I think it was massive help to play Wagon's Ace. I mean, I was total culture shock the first few rounds there. Just it was completely new to me, the whole thing, because I played with this before, but I completely forgot how it was. And I was highly disturbed by the time control at the beginning, like the whole event. If you remember Wagon's Ace, okay, also this whole protest thing was highly disturbing.
In the first round.
Yeah. This first round, you remember this Fedosev resigned after 10 moves or something, he blundered something. I blundered to Vincent. A ridiculous thing that I just never, I mean, I usually don't blunder, so I just blundered a classical game.
And you feel the connection with the protest.
Not only, but time control especially, and this whole, the whole, I mean, for me it was a combination of like anxiety of the start of the tournament and the time control, and of course certain things, particularly technical in the game, that went not my way. But of course, when things already go wrong, like this weird, because, you know, in general, when you play chess, or maybe it's true for all sports, but for chess, at least I know because I play it, you do so much to protect your routine, because it's like, even breakfast, I take exactly the same things after the first day. Okay, maybe you can say that just because I'm a weirdo, but I think that it's really a thing that most sportsmen do. They protect their routine, and this is where, you know, they have some peace of mind, and even the smallest disruption to that could be unpleasant. But there we had the whole, like, it was completely ridiculous. Like, we came to the playing venue, there was no way to enter, there was total chaos, there was very weird contact with the organizers, like it was not clear where they are, what we have to do. Many people thought the round maybe already starting, so we all forced our way through inside. Turned out there was no one inside, so there was no need to go in. Some people got emails that actually they can stay in the room. Some people from one hotel heard it, you know, the other from the other hotel didn't. Some people went back to the room, some people stayed. It was highly disturbing, of course, and the whole tournament started off extremely strange for most players. They all played very strange, and time control added to it a lot, and finally after some time it's all stabilized somewhat. And by now I've already played this time control in a lot of games. It was 13 plus 14, that's crazy. It's I played so many games with it that by now I have some feel for it. But it remains a difficult time control, because managing your time without increment, this is a very difficult skill.
I was wondering if this was, again, the ghost or influence of Magnus hovering over the chess world, because everyone was so happy with the much more honest increment a method, which, we had Bobby Fischer to thank for. And Magnus Carlsen has often expressed his wish that time control should be unforgiving, which this one is very much. I mean, you have to manage your time, otherwise you're in big trouble. How good is the idea? I mean, on which side are you?
No, I mean, it makes sense. I'm conflicted, because there's a small conflict of interest in there. Plus there is, you know, sometimes, for example, a good example is that I think I perform really well in morning games. I have noticed, I didn't run the numbers, but I have an intuitive feeling that I'm overscoring crazy in morning games, but I hate them. But I'm sure my opponents hate them much more. So you could dislike something and yet it could be to your advantage. And I think everybody dislikes this time control, but it is to the advantage of some people. And there is definitely something to say for making chess more challenging for players, because of course, you want to make defense harder, because obviously with better defense it's harder to win games, and you want less, of course you want more variety, you want more wins, you want more mistakes, as on one hand the players get stronger and stronger, at the same time you do want to keep, you know, the them, you know, put them under pressure. And so I see the point, and also you could argue you have no less time than with increment, you just have to manage it better.
Mm-hmm.
So no, it's very sensible. Very sensible. I mean, I think increment is really helpful in blitz games, because then without it it's decided by some chaos, especially over the board. Online mm-hmm. blitz you can play without increment, because there is clear environment, right, where nothing can go wrong, and there the server will decide who won, who lost. There is no arbitration. There's nothing. But in over the board chess, it can get very messy. But in classical, it doesn't come down to seconds usually. Yeah. So I think classical chess with no increment is okay. There's something to say for it. And the other thing is again that, like, maybe it's good, but we have a lot of different time controls everywhere, and maybe that makes chess more rich and more challenging and more interesting. But it does make it harder for players. So maybe that's good again, but it's something to acknowledge. Like, we have, and something to acknowledge is also that it's really hard to switch for a player from one to the other. Like, it's really different to play one control over the other. Yeah. But in general, I think in terms of the percentages of draws in tournaments, I think we are in a fine place right now. At some point, did some brief comparison through the years of top tournaments. And I think it's not getting worse. Like, the draw percentage doesn't increase.
Yeah.
And I think we have... I think that's natural, because you have certain players that are stronger than others, or think they are stronger than others, mostly are also. And they need to find ways to show that they're stronger than others by winning those games.
Yeah.
And... they find ways to do it. Like, they basically, it's kind of like survival of the fittest in a way. Yeah. Like, and the game offers enough, game is rich enough to give room to players who think they're stronger than others and play for a win.
Mm-hmm.
It is probably easier to play for a draw now than before, but if you go into a tournament and you believe that you're the strongest player, you're not going to be playing for a draw, right? Because what is good is achieving draws with these idiots, right? Because you are the great one, right?
Yeah.
And maybe you are the great one, because maybe you have a high rating. Let's say if you have another back with 2780, going into a tournament full of 2700s, he has to win games, so he will play, he will do whatever he can to try to win games. But if you are a 2680 player entering tournament 2750s and draws are good for you, it is now easier than before to make those draws, to try to make those draws. I believe it's kind of easier, but okay, now I also contradict myself, because, you know, how can it be easier for one and not the harder for the other? But you know, basically, let me just say that if you have a player, let me put it like that, a player from the past, if you freeze him and bring to the current time, it is easier now for a weaker player to draw the dinosaur from before. Let me put it this way. That's the right way to put it. But Nodirbek will be hard to draw regardless.
Nodirbek, Abdus Satorov, we're talking about, because these days there are several...
Actually, any Nodirbek is really hard to draw. There's any a bunch. And a Javahir also, and a Jahangir.
Let's talk about Javahir. Yeah. Javahir Sindarov, who, he's had a great year. He's not exactly appearing out of the blue, but still the way he won this was... I don't think many people had expected that. I mean, for me, he was one of the dark horses as a possible favorite, but not like this. How does it happen, a thing like this? Is that...
Yeah, you need probably some time to see whether this is a sort of peak Javahir, you know, that has jumped a couple heads above his regular level, or if he's improving, let's say, so much that in fact this is not that much above his level. This is more or less, maybe this is more or less his level, right?
Or all the stars were aligned.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they were anyway aligned. But the question is, like, basically, is it a 2750 Java here who got very lucky? Or is it a 2790 Java here who got a little bit lucky? Or do we have a 2830 Java here who just got very slightly lucky, because actually normal?
Yeah.
You know? Or maybe is it 2900 Java here? He just underrated.
Yeah.
And he just evolved in the last few months, because actually, if you look back, he won the World Cup. He almost won Waikanae. He now won this. His performance over the last half year is huge. So maybe he's just improved to the extent that this is just normal for him and he will just crush everyone from now on.
Yeah.
I'll be really surprised with that. I'm somewhat skeptical. I mean, he's great. He has a lot of great qualities. But he's already 20, and you improve at this age for sure. But if you would be sort of the new dominant force in chess, we would have probably noticed already by now. But maybe not. We'll see. Everybody has their own progress chart. In any case, this result was tremendous, and it's even though the stars were aligned, it's not like everybody blundered rooks against him. He did a lot of good things, and he has a very nice style. There are like two things that are striking, and everybody noticed that those things. It's not a secret. So one is that he's very fast, and the other is that he's very universal. He has displayed multiple qualities across. So like, and he seemed good in complicated positions, and in the simple ones, and on the offensive, and on the defensive. And that is actually rare. So in that sense, if you say that the player is very universally good and he's fast, that player could potentially be the best player in the world. I can imagine that. But the thing is also, it's very tempting, because whenever you see somebody in good form, he always looks magnificent. And whenever you see somebody in bad form, it looks bad. So I imagine maybe his bad form would look that he is too fast, impatient. And the fact that you don't have big weaknesses usually also means that maybe you don't have extreme strengths either. Mm-hmm. So it's all, different sides to the same coin. But we'll see. In any case, it's very exciting that somebody had a result like this. And everybody's looking forward to more of his results, for sure.
Yeah, well, some people, they were drawing parallels with Gukesh. I mean, who had these fantastic results and then capped that with a candidate's win. And then, stalled and now is trying to find his old self.
Exactly. So, exactly. Like with Gukesh, you would expect that he was growing, right, towards something. And but it seems that there was as though almost degradation, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, in terms of his rating, it definitely degraded.
Yeah.
In terms of his growth curve, it seems like he started going down from some point onwards, which is not at all what you would expect from a young player who was coming up. So now with this example of Gukesh so far, I think everybody's also cautious to not to sort of take a wait and see approach with Java here and not proclaim him as the next best. In fact, if you really want to replace Magnus, and you desperately need the candidate for that job, I would vouch for Erdogmus. He is only 14.
He's
about to break 2700 right now. He's like one win against Topalov away. He already won a couple of games.
Yeah, last what I saw was he was two up, but he's...
Yes, so one more win and he is 2700.
Yeah.
And that is a trajectory that hasn't been seen before. If we really are looking for a player who would somehow find a way to dominate modern chess, which I believe is extremely difficult, and I don't think it's impossible, but I think that it's very, very difficult. But if you are looking for a player like that, okay, Java here is a good candidate, but... Erdogmus also looks very good, so I think this is an exciting time. So we're about to witness.
Yeah, we all also saw Erdogmus in Waikanae, where he was doing very well to a certain point, and it was clear from the way he behaved that he was thinking about tournament victory. I mean, there was no modesty there.
I saw from up close his amazing games, so I see the miracle. But it so happened that against me, he did play. He played a bad game. He did play a bad game against me. So I haven't yet witnessed it from across the table, but I am sure I'll get to soon. And I saw some of his games. Like, this game against Arjun was absolutely extraordinary. Like, And also he has this thing that he thinks in the opening, like for very long, and then he either remembers the prep or he finds it. He has this weird thing where like he spends like 40 minutes. He did it against me too. He spends like 40 minutes in a position that he probably has looked at and starts making the top engine moves. And I think he's probably recollecting his mm-hmm. prep. Or maybe he sort of combines the recollecting and calculating. But yeah, this game against Arjun worked perfectly. Against me, it didn't work very well because position remained slightly worse for him, unpleasant, and the time deficit cost him. But against Arjun, this time investment he did worked out well. Okay, right now, of course, he's also quite a slow player. But okay, I mean, 2700 at 14, let's not look into the small finesses that we could fix. I mean, this is just extraordinary.
He often got into time trouble, but there he still most of the time he seemed in control.
Exactly. He's and again, I don't think we have seen the final form of his, right? He's just 14, so yeah. The player that he's right now, if you just show me his, I'm not so impressed with that player. But if you tell me he's 14, then I'm impressed. I think right now he has flaws, and I'm not scared as in right now. If I have to play him tomorrow, I'm not scared. But if I imagine I have to play him in 5 years, I don't want to bet on myself, let's say.
No, but it's funny that we were watching the boom in India, and we were talking about India for a long time, and now suddenly it's the people breaking through in Uzbekistan, and Turkey is huge.
Uzbekistan having a crazy run, both Jawahir, but also Nurdebek, outside the World Championship cycle, he's on an insane run of great events.
Yeah. Well, when we're talking about, let's say the predictability of his success in Sindarov's case, there might be people who say, well, he's been working with his new coach, Roman Fedonyak, from January last year till now, and up, stable improvement. He's cashing in on that. I mean, he's just grown with his new coach.
Well, I actually also had a chance to work with his coach.
Yeah.
So.
That's why I wanted to ask you.
I don't have to fear the unknown.
No.
I can fear the known. We didn't get to really do it in full.
How long was your session?
I think we had a few sessions.
A few days, you mean?
Yeah, a few days, a couple times. So I think first met, he worked also with Jordan at some point, and then he was a coach of our national team briefly.
Yeah.
That's how I got to know him personally, and then I did a few things with him on my own. I think, to be honest, I think the training methods he uses, I think they could be very beneficial if they are if you sort of put those things on a very talented player who has I don't think anybody going through his coaching would transform into an amazing player.
Unless you already have the...
I think certain players maybe are perceptive. So he basically works on certain areas of your game. And I think that maybe in some players, this work could really... basically, he taps into your potential in one area of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And some players have a big potential there to tap into, and some probably don't.
Mm-hmm.
And it probably is the case that Jawahir, this has been very useful.
Mm-hmm.
I also have a feeling, I don't know if that's maybe my feeling from the outside, that Jawahir is enjoying the same thing that Nepo was also enjoying, is that... if you were a player who has been improving and neglecting a big part of chess upbringing, like for example like opening preparation. If you've been, and despite that, so you say you're improving and you just don't really work on your openings for a very long time, and you keep improving because of your natural talent, at some point you end up reaching a 2700 level, and then you probably start stagnating a little bit. If in that moment you suddenly start working like mad on the openings, for example, you experience a massive boost.
Mm-hmm.
And usually players tap into that potential at an earlier stage, when they are weaker grandmasters, and they experience the boost earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But these guys, they have tapped into it at the last stage,
mm-hmm.
and they have this final boost,
mm-hmm.
which catapults them from 2700 to world championship candidate. I think this is also what he's going through right now. I think Joe here has never been this well prepared in his life at all. And
that's the funny thing that Fidoňák, he says, I'm not interested
in the openings. Oh, that's the other thing. Exactly. Yeah. So, and at the same time, he's also working on his other chess skills with Fidoňák. So he's been doing a highly balanced training for a year. And probably before that, he was mostly relying on his natural talent without having all this untapped potential.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, I think he was an amazing player who reached 2700 more, like, to simplify, more or less on his raw talent. And after that, he started tapping into the Fidoňák potential and the opening potential at the same time.
Yeah.
And so now he's on, basically, he's on a complete high, channeling like from two, you know, sources of extra power,
mm-hmm.
experiencing a massive double boost.
Mm-hmm.
I think the challenge comes later for him.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, this potential will expire somewhat and the gains will start being marginal.
Mm-hmm.
This is what Nepo is going through right now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Nepo can no longer tap into that potential because he's already tapped into it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start, and then you start stagnating again.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, how far do you reach until you stagnate again? And maybe for Java here, this is world championship 800 and so on, so we'll see.
Yeah, but you also mean that he was a huge junior talent. He was a prodigy. He was
grandmaster at 12.
Yeah, he was very, very young. So there was lots and lots of raw talent.
Absolutely.
And this is the next.
Yeah, the thing is that a lot of players started tapping into those reserves when they were 2500 to 2600.
Yeah, yeah.
But he wasn't doing it until he got to 2680, let's say. And maybe the other players could not reach 2680 without tapping into them. But it is, I see the repeat of a Nepo phenomenon, like, but much faster, because Nepo's been having a bunch of years where he essentially wasn't moving, neither upwards nor down, and Java here timed it quite well. For example, I personally started working like mad on openings much earlier, and I experienced massive growth from 2500 to 2700. But by the time I was 2700, I already tapped into that opening work potential. You know, it's like this big box with the turbo boost that you can open at any moment as a player. You can open it when you are weaker, you can open it when you're stronger. And if you open it at the, you know, when you're already a top player, then you get to, I mean, multiple players, I think Ravin Chidambaram had that thing too. Some people, for example, they open like cannot, like, let's say you have guys who are always good at openings. Bluebaum is great at openings, Dubov is great at openings, right? They don't have that reserve. They can't be greater at openings.
No.
The guy who is not good at openings, he can now start working on openings and just catapult. But at some point it ends. Like, it's a boost. You could say, like, maybe it's, I don't know, it's 80 rank points or 50 rank points. So I think the Java here is now going through a big growth, but I guess at some point it will stagnate. The question, will it stagnate at 2780 or at 2850 or where? So that's a big question. But I think that, yeah, this work he does with Roman, and at the same time, the prep. I mean, okay, it's all nice that they work on the board, but blitzing out 20 moves of theory every day I mean, it's not coming from the board, yeah? Laptop, there's laptop in there somewhere. I mean,
When he's working with Roman, then they have... they just play board, no laptops.
Yeah, yeah, that's what... So they work on that, but he also works on his openings. I mean, there's evidence to that. Yeah. I don't need to see interviews. I see it blitzing out moves every single game.
And that's the laptop.
That's the laptop. Laptop is there somewhere at some point. At some point... he goes, you know, Coach Roman goes home, you know, and Mafia falls asleep and Javahir opens his laptop. So there is that. And he probably goes through a very balanced, nice chess training where he gets to combine the working at the board and working on the laptop as well.
Yeah. Do you think that is the big gain in the level of chess that people generally work much harder than in the old days, that let's say the way you work on openings, or that many leading grandmasters work on openings, I think the laymen at home have no idea how intense and how deep that goes. And then you have these new training methods. I mean, I was listening to the kind of tests that he subjects his pupils to. I mean, Roman Fidanyak, and that sounds pretty tough. And then you have all
thing,
these...
It's entirely new, to be fair. I mean, I think essentially it is a version of Dvoretsky. It's a version of Dvoretsky.
But did he also let's say, I was thinking about the visualization test that Ramesh does, where he really expects extraordinary, strength at that level. Mm-hmm. And you think that comes from Dvoretsky?
I don't know, maybe it was already before. I'm not really big on chess coaching history, but essentially this whole idea of working by calculating certain positions, trying to solve certain positions, I know it is a Dvoretsky thing. Maybe it must have been before as well, right?
I think the toughness was... The toughness of the
exercises,
how deep they went and how far you had.
Yeah, in fact, I spoke to Roman. He was educating me a bit on this. He was telling me about influence that he had from coaches in Lviv, Ukraine, back then USSR at some point. He was telling me about older coaches that had influence on him. I don't know what the timeline was, if these coaches were before Dvoretsky or...
One of them that he mentioned to me was Dorfman, Josef Dorfman.
Oh, yeah, but I meant someone else. Dorfman is not. I meant someone from Lviv, from Ukraine.
Oh, yeah.
He was there specifically a few coaches from Ukraine also. Mm-hmm. Dorfman, I think the most, like, between the sort of chess professionals, Dvoretsky is like the OG, OG. He's the OG. I think... But personally, I think Roman is like, I find him a very likable, very humorous, funny. I had a lot of funny stories with him. I don't even want to tell. But we had like a lot of fun, and he's such a, I think he has great vibes. And the whole team, I think there is very much united with that. I think Sindarov, Javahir himself, I think this kid Madaminov looks super friendly, and the vibes are very good. They're very positive. Yeah. And I had very pleasant experience working with Roman, so I think that is very important as well, to have just be a very positive person.
Yeah, that's what Sindarov also stressed. We have a lot of fun too.
Yeah, no, he's a very good vibes person. Yeah. But in terms of how I would view... I mean, I hope he doesn't feel it as an insult or by no means, but how I would view the training, I would just say that it is his twist or his vision on essentially the method of solving positions, which is not new by no means. There are tons of books with solving positions. There is tons of coaches now and before, and of course Ramesh is very well known. Dvoretsky was known before that. I worked as a kid growing up with this Bariev chess school. We had these guys like some Chekhov, Arkhipov, these grandmasters from Russia, giving us positions to solve, blindfold positions to solve. I mean, it was all there, always it was there. I don't know, Kotov wrote the book about calculation, right? He was probably the OG.
Do you think like a grandmaster?
Yes. Yeah. I don't know if he also was encouraging solving exercises or not, but he was the first person I know who was really talking about the theory of
well,
population.
He was God for some time, and now I think it's you should say that it makes no sense at
no,
all.
No, of course, but let's say he was the first guy.
Yeah,
of course it makes no sense, obviously, but he was probably the first guy who put into writing that lets us talk about calculation. Let's acknowledge the elephant in the room. And now I forgot to mention Jakob Agard. Jakob Agard, also prominent, probably you have to also as employee, right? To praise Jacob in every podcast.
Well, he's definitely, very much influenced.
Yeah,
by
in
Dvoretsky.
Fact, I also had indirect, like I didn't get a chance to... but I indirectly also know Jacob very well, and his material has also been very helpful for me as well, the books, and also, he has this whole thing with a lot of positions. So I do not think that Joe Hirsch's coach, Roman, has some kind of sacred something. And I think that if you give that sacred something to an ordinary player, he will remain an ordinary player, but slightly improved. Mm-hmm. But I think that maybe Joe here has a special talent, which he is able to unleash thanks to work with his coaches.
Yeah.
I would credit both of them.
Yeah.
And not, if you are an ordinary grandmaster doesn't possess the talent of Joe here, and you instead, you say, okay, Roman, I'll pay you quadruple, leave Joe here, come to me.
Mm.
And he will do the same what he does with Joe here, the effect will not be the same.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think it really is that he is able to untap the potential of an incredibly talented player.
Yeah.
And I think we should credit Joe here himself as well a lot there.
Yeah. Well, what I understand is that the philosophy kind of is that you can train your muscles, why can't you train your brain?
Yeah.
So you can make your brain better. But you might argue that is already something that started with Dvoretsky by giving more complicated tasks than people were used to.
Sure, and also there is a thing of like, but when you're playing a game of chess, you are training those muscles. It's like, I remember you told me that at some point that somebody discovered that the best way to train for penalties was to do penalties, right?
Makes sense.
Yeah, this is your wisdom. You told me that some football people discovered that. But again, also for penalties, you can probably train shooting from different distances and train other things and shooting into smaller goal and stuff like that. But probably the best way to, and also probably the best way to improve at chess is to play chess. I mean, and you have lots of great players. Magnus is a well-known hater of solving positions. Yeah, well-known publicly. He's many times said that he thinks it's completely useless and he does not good
solving.
At it. Solving aside. Magnus famously says that he says that he thinks it's useless. He says he thinks he's bad at it, and he's never really done it. And he thinks that it's not needed. So he was able to become who he became without this.
So we believe him that he.
No. Again, I'm saying that maybe, maybe for him. By the way, this is not a big area of
that he didn't need.
Or maybe it is. Maybe he became amazing despite this. Maybe imagine Magnus who would be working with Roman. What he would get, Jesus, yeah? No, imagine that. Imagine Magnus with Roman. Oh no. Yeah. Get me out of here. Yeah, that would be something, right?
That's funny because I asked Roman, if you look back at all the world champions from the old days, I say, were there any of them that you would have loved to work with? And he started to glow and he said, all of them.
Yes, I think Roman thinks, for sure, he thinks that if only this Magnus guy would listen to me, we could do so many great things together. He could finally crack 2900.
Yeah.
He could finally, I don't even know what is there to achieve for Magnus in 2900, maybe 3000.
Yeah.
So,
just imagine what Zuckertort could have been.
Yeah. It's not so simple, let's say. We have Joe here, we also have Magnus. And again, I think that Roman has his own view on this. He has he's putting in amazing work. Let's say his own twist to this is quite a twist. He puts in a lot of thought into this stuff, and not to take any credit away, he's doing a tremendous job.
Yeah.
But I don't think he has discovered entirely a new field of chess. Essentially, it is a variation on this whole notion of working on chess by solving positions, which is Dvoretsky, Agard, Ramesh, many others are essentially doing that.
Well, and I think he also makes connections to sports science because that was what he was trained in, and to his mind, chess is in certain areas, chess is totally underdeveloped. So
this is absolutely true, of course. It's very interesting to talk to. I talked to him about all these things. It was very interesting, and I think he has impact on me as well, for sure, without a doubt. I think a lot of my results lately are also owed to. I didn't do the work with him that Jawahir did, but I did do some work with and without him also, where I think he definitely, he has inspired me for sure. And just, you know, just when I met him, it happened to be that I was in a horrible shape. I was at my lowest when I met him first time, because I was at the, it was the team training camp, and I was at my low rating low before Olympiad. And I remember he told me, he told me that I should just try to become world champion. And I thought, like why now? Like, I mean, like, can I get back to like 27:30, please, or whatever it was? Like, why now? Like, do you think I should hear that I want to become? I mean, of course, I want to become a champion, but like, you should have told me that half year ago or half year later. Why now? You know, like, can I please just? It was very inspiring and. I really thought a lot about the work we did and tried to implement a lot of things as well. It works very well for Jawahir. But again, it works with Jawahir. Magnus didn't do that, right? Everybody has their own approach and everybody has unique talents and everybody has certain potentials that they can tap into, and everybody has to discover it for himself what it is for them.
Yeah, and as far as I understand, all the listeners at home can try it at some point, because he's writing a book on his method, so at some point...
Yeah, but honestly, for the listeners, there are plenty of materials. Like, I can only recommend... Of course, there is the whole Dvoryevsky-Yusupov thing. Agard books are incredible. He has... it's like a sponsored podcast, but it's really... It's well known. I mean, I remember there's this book called Defense Manual or something like this. And it has this hammer, but there's some nice board. It's epic design of the front page. Something hammer and some kind of chessboard, I think. There's an attacking manual and a defensive manual.
Yeah.
And defensive manual is absolutely epic. Like, the positions there, as a young player, I remember... it was a collection of exercises. They were so beautiful, all of them. Somehow I found the defensive exercises more beautiful than attacking. Like, I was already like attacking, of course. I was a big fan of Kasparov. Generally, I loved attacking chess as a kid, but all these amazing defensive resources, I found them in some sense so much more pretty. And I think there is plenty of literature on the topic of chess calculation, but and positions to solve, all the puzzle books and and also Lichess has now incredible puzzle database. Lichess puzzles are amazing, really, really amazing. Like, I've sometimes solved Lichess puzzles and I start to wonder like what else do you need, really? Like, honestly, it's really good stuff. Of course, professional coach, I mean, there's difference here and there, but it's really good. Like, but you know, it sounds tempting, but it's one of the hardest things to consistently do these calculation exercises. It is extremely hard work, and I'm curious which of the listeners will sustain it, because it is really very hard work with a very little dose of dopamine in the end, far less than what you are used to nowadays.
Well, then fortunately, there's also other ways you can enjoy chess.
It's much easier to enjoy it in the other ways. So definitely, sure.
You love chess? Why don't you try New in Chess? With readers in 116 countries, New in Chess is the premier chess magazine in the world. What will you get? Exciting chess games explained by the best experts in a clear and accessible way, on-the-spot reports of the biggest events, top-notch instruction, independent journalism, chess history that comes to life, and great interviews. New in Chess, the way you want it. The beautifully produced paper edition or the digital edition for phone, tablet or PC. Give it a try. Go to our website, newinchess.com/magazine, for more information about subscriptions and special offers.
No, I think this has been great, Anish, your take on the candidates and your own results, the success of Sindarov. The new name that you have to remember, listeners, Roman Vidonjak. We haven't spoken about Untold Chess Mates. Shall we skip it? Or?
No, it's painful. Yeah, it's such a good topic to talk about. Mm. And
Let's keep it simple. Yeah. Well, so we're talking about the Netflix documentary on Niemann and Carlsen. Did you like it?
I was surprised to see. I sort of knew that, not fully, but I had already guessed what has transpired. Mm. I had guessed that basically Magnus felt misled by chess.com, by Danny, essentially. Mm. I have felt that, but he just literally said it. It shocked me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but I guess they have agreed that, you know, they'll make Denny a scapegoat. Denny is a nice guy. He has a book on his crazy life. He was wrong. He admits it. Mm-hmm. It's okay. He moves on. Chess.com logo is on the on the Netflix. It's also good. I was surprised. They just basically, as far as I understood, they just made like a scapegoat out of Denny.
Yeah.
Put all the sins on him, and Magnus is good, Hans is amazing, everybody is good, even Eric Calabest is good. It's just Dennis falls everything for him. And Dennis, they're like, yeah, I was wrong, whatever, you know, like I'm sorry, and they're like, yeah, sure, Danny, we love you, you're so likable anyway, and you can make mistakes, and he already made plenty, and he's a nice guy, so I think it was a happy end story. And now Hans is also he has his Endgame AI venture, and I also can imagine, because I also started my thing with Chess Monitor, right? And I'm, in a way, it's so nice when you have something of your own and not just working for other as an ambassador to other projects, which is what most chess players did for a long time or do. It is so nice when you feel like you have your own project that you can, in your free time, you know, you don't have to anymore think about what else you're doing, which contracts you have with which companies, what is their vision, does it align with yours, you know, do you like chess.com, you want to work with them or not, or did they, you know, or is there a competitor now, or like all these things, and what do you want to promote, and just doing some project where you can do what you really want to do without having to compromise with anybody. I think for Hans, this it's this Endgame AI thing right now. For me, it's my project as well.
Tell us about your project. What is it called, and what does it bring?
I started this Chess Monitor. It's already a website, that company basically, that already existed before me. Mm. Some point I discovered it. It was a nice tool to quickly look up games of players on their Lichess or Chess.com accounts. And it basically had like a database, a very nice way to see the games in like a tree form. There was like a chess engine. So I was using it to just look at online accounts of players. Yeah, because you have, sometimes I was preparing for some players that play a lot online, like Hikaru, let's say. And it was very easy to look up all his games online. Because, you know, what I used to do, like on Chessbase, you could just see the regular games. But here it was very easy and very fast. So I used it a bit. But I thought it's a very small niche product that this was very nice, clean, very little, like very small. And then I got in touch with the developer, and eventually, you know, I realized that I had a lot of plans that I wanted to do, a lot of projects. Like mostly, I want to, of course, bring out my opening content, like how I did for Chessable, but to do it in a way that I want to do it, in a format that I want to do it without having to compromise. And I realized that Chess Monitor kind of a perfect foundation for that, because to build it in an environment that already has like, he has, you know, basically the backend for like the database, and he has all these things that he already built. And what I want to build is basically, he basically already started it. And I can just sort of continue where he left off in a way, and we can continue together, and I can then do all my opening content there. And I don't have to, because, you know, sometimes I wonder with Chessable, they tell me, yeah, make this. At some point they said, you have to make neither for noobs, you know. Sounds very good, by the way, but catch a name. I give him that. But, you know, I mean, they had their own vision because they want to go for a wider audience, which is even weaker, which I think doesn't need my courses. They need other courses. Even Roman is too early for them, right? So here I can do content in the way that I want to do. Mm-hmm. And I was really lucky that I met Thomas, who was behind this chess monitor, who mm-hmm. could do it with me. And I think it's really a nice thing that you can have something, build something like this yourself. And there are only a few players that are blessed enough to have that. And yeah. Magnus is one, of course, who mm-hmm. had this epic, you know, epic set of companies that that he was a part of. And Hans is our chess mate.
Yeah.
Also has it now. Mm. And I was very lucky that even though I don't have their kind of fame, I was still able to be lucky enough to find a partner in Thomas, and I can do also my own project. And it's a very slow thing because, you know, it's like I'm also really busy now playing. I was planning to do more there, but with candidates, of course, I had to delay my content production.
Yeah.
First, okay, I have to use my content for my own games. Mm. But eventually I will, it's a slow, you know, project. And now also we actually even have an app where can prepare for the games. It's kind of like a little everything is there. Like you can look up the player. There's a mega. There's like a base, not called mega base. It's like a, there's a it's called master database. The engine is there. So like all the essentials are there. And eventually, I also want to put my content on the app. And then basically, you have a nice app for preparation. It's a very niche kind of product, right? It's for people that actually prepare for their games, which is not that big market that chess.com is all aiming for. But it's something that, you know, where I feel I can make the most impact.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there is a big potential there because it's a lot of players that are young and up and coming. You know, the future, like the not even Faustino Oro, but even the smaller one, like the future top players, the future grandmasters, or chess fans that are very serious. Because you have those chess fans that play weekly games in their club, but they are preparing very hard. In Holland, it's very popular. Like in Holland, you have a lot of these guys who are like FIDE masters or even week or like club players, and they're not very strong, but they really like their openings and prepare.
Yeah.
So it is for people that actually prepare, you know?
Yeah.
And this is a small, it is a small market. But on one hand, it's a market of people that are actually ready to spend on chess, which is nice.
Mm-hmm.
But more than that, why I want to do this is because that's where I can make an impact, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because this is where, for them, it makes a difference. Is it my course or is the course of a random player who is also good but not as knowledgeable as me in the openings? Whereas for a beginner, I can't make that impact. In fact, if I'll teach a beginner, I will do a worse job than a teacher of the beginner because they know better.
Yeah.
Sometimes I see some videos like Levy gets the Elo or whatever. He knows, he can predict moves of beginners so much better. He's because he's been a coach for young for kids and he can teach kids a lower rated player so much better than me. But what I do best is do this opening work for serious kind of players that are serious about openings. And I think that this is something where I can make an impact. And okay, whether it will be like a big business thing or not, I don't know, but at least it's something where I know that if I have free time outside of my chess or if I want to do something for the future, then this is something where I can do it myself.
So chessmonitor.com. That's where
yes.
That's where they can find more about this project. Great, Anish. Well, thank you very much. It's really nice to meet here in Paphos, Cyprus. We're sitting on the 7th floor of a fine hotel.
Yeah, the view is amazing, for sure.
The Mediterranean is out there.
I took the picture of this little, I don't know if it's an island or a rock, like it's something in between. I've taken picture of the thing from all angles. I have a phone gallery of this little rock. It's just, one of them is uploaded on Twitter, by the way. It's just
okay.
It's a beautiful thing. I don't know. Do you think it's an island or a rock?
Both. I will check on your Insta page on this island rock. Okay, well, thanks a lot, Anish, and good luck with everything you're doing.
Thank you, Rikan. Thank you very much, Rikan.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the New in Chess podcast. The New in Chess podcast can be listened to on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and the New in Chess website. To leave a comment, go to our socials or email us directly at podcast@newinchess.com. If this podcast has gotten you in the mood to read a fine chess book or to subscribe to the wonderful New in Chess magazine, then please have a look at our shop on our website, newinchess.com, where you can treat yourself to a great read. We thank our sponsors at DGT for their support and hope to have you back for a new episode of the New in Chess podcast.